Welcome to the Reality Revolution. I'm your host, Brian Scott. We have a special episode today. We're going to focus on the idea of the magical power of service. I've studied all aspects of magic and power. I've studied all the occult literature, all of the old secret schools and the mystery schools, and I've studied power and magic and so many different things. And I'm about to tell you something that has been such a huge revelation for me. And you may suspect the truth of it, but you're going to have to test it out and understand its power. In the Law of One material, and in many other podcasts, we've begun to discuss this unique aspect of third density old earth experience. This consciousness that we're in right now is designed about you making a single choice, making a single decision. It's all designed as this sort of simulation that is putting you in a variety of situations over thousands or millions of years until you make a single choice. And the nature of this choice is in what you give service to. Service, for many, is a loaded word. When you hear the word service, you think that means something that you have to do against your will, or something that you have to do that you don't really want to do for someone else. Whatever it is, you have thoughts in your mind. You might take that word service and make it sound like work. Doing service is some kind of work or job that you have to do. It is not that at all. When we talk about the whole universe being created by a single thought, the one original thought, and the way the densities move and how you graduate and go through different levels of consciousness, the whole system is designed around service. Service, in many ways, is attention. But the nature of your intentions and your attention, both of those being very similar. Once you become aware, like a little baby who opens his eyes, that you're creating your reality, that this world that you live in is more than just a feeling normal, regular world. It's actually a grand illusion or matrix that is designed to test you and to reveal to you. It's designed as a classroom that teaches you. We're being led along a journey that is both unique and powerful and different for everyone. Each journey is different. But the one thing that's common among all of them is service. And as I've studied power, I have found when you commit to the service of others, when you commit to service of mankind, when you commit to service of something outside of yourself, and you make the decision, you make the choice, when you do that thing, you are given incredible power. And the more you do it, the more power that you get. It's a magical power. You can use this magic for so many amazing things. You can change the world. You can change the universe when you have this power. And you're given more of it the more service that you perform. But the surprising thing is, along the way, it's less and less important that you have power. And then it becomes love. You got a chance to check out the lecture by Neville Goddard, Moses, Elijah, and Jesus. He explains that the Bible is in the order that it's in, so that you see the order of the states in the Bible, because those characters are just states. And the first state is Moses, who's bringing you out of this illusion. The illusion is Egypt that you're in. You're trying to escape the illusion that you're in. And he brings you out. And then the next prophet is Elijah, who is the power. Right. But with no love. And then love is Jesus, right? And once you have the love, then you have the power. and love and service are very closely intertwined. When you perform a service for others, it's a unique, powerful sort of love that accumulates very much like a very valuable stock. It has compound interest in what it provides you. And I wanted to discuss this and its spiritual power and how important it is. The Bhagavad Gita, for instance, provides one with a code of conduct. Whenever we are in trouble, doubt, or despair, we can turn to the code. Mahatma Gandhi said, "It lays down the God-created man and at the same time imposed on him the duty of yajna, or sacrifice." But these words are derived from roots, meaning that which purifies. The Lord says, "By sacrifice shall you propagate your kind." Sacrifice here means service. The Gita says that he who serves only himself is a thief. Sacrifice, serve ye for the gods, and pleased they will give you the reward of your sacrifice. There is no higher law than the law of yajna, the law of service. Yajna means an act directed to the welfare of others, done without desiring any return for it, whether of a temporal or spiritual nature. Thus, this is the crux of this magical power. You cannot do it expecting anything in return. It's done naturally. So it is a mental aspect. It is a way of being. It's not just in the actions that you take. It goes beyond that to your sort of worldview, the way you see the world when you walk into the grocery store, when you see other people, when you interact with them. Is it all about you getting through the store and getting as quickly as possible, ignoring everybody? Or do you see other people and how you can be of service to them even in that environment? Do you imagine them being more beautiful? Imagine them being more wealthy? Imagine them being more happy in that service that you can provide? If somebody drops something, you pick it up, right? It's the way that you are all the time. So when we say the yajna means an act directed to the welfare of others, done without desiring any return for it, whether of a temporal or spiritual nature, act here must be taken in its widest sense and includes thought, word, and deed. Others embraces not only humanity, but all life. The Gita teaches and experiences testify that all action that cannot come under the category of yajna promotes bondage. The world cannot subsist for a single moment without yajna, and therefore the Gita, after having dealt with true wisdom and the means of attaining it, declares in so many words that yajna came with creation itself. This body therefore has been given to us only so that we may serve all creation with it. And that was Mahatma Gandhi. There's also Swami Chinmayananda, who talks about acting in the yajna spirit. The Upanishads glorify service as the highest pinnacle of right living. Dedicated and noble work alone can polish an individual to the state of true culture and right discipline. To those who know what service is, work is not considered as slavery or drudgery, but it reflects the joy of life. Man is not born to revel in idleness. Nature will whip the idle onto the road of activity and thereby evolve them steadily to a state of joy. That state is characterized by dynamic outer activity yet inner peace. Vedanta has never permitted escapism, though many uninformed people contend it does. The earliest Upanishads emphasized that one who cannot live a noble life of renunciation and self-restraint must unavoidably live a life of intense activity, striving to fulfill one's desires through honest means, teaching oneself to live in a cheerful enthusiasm, dedicated to the service of man and in the glorification of the Lord. The one who intensively plunges into life eager and anxious to meet its challenges with truth and purity as standards. To such a person, actions do not cling. Living the entire lifetime in a spirit of paying homage to the Lord, detached from anxiety for the fruit of actions and from the ego sense, is lauded not only by the Bhagavad Gita, but also by the Upanishads. Such actions are necessary to prepare a student for the higher flights of meditation. To a seeker, dedicated work is a means for the inner purification of his mental impressions, vasana. Each of us born into a life ordered by our vasana, and the circumstances around us provide an opportunity to exhaust them. Therefore, whatever field we are working in today, that becomes the place to polish our inner equipment. All work is noble when we undertake it in the right spirit of selflessness and detachment. Of themselves, actions are neutral, neither good nor bad. It is the doer's motive that determines the quality of the action. Even the makers of secular laws recognize this. In the penal code, one is accused of manslaughter only when intention to murder is proven. If not, it only amounts to culpable homicide. Actions which spring from selfishness leave vasana behind, creating more and more agitations, but selfless actions lead to their exhaustion. We must therefore learn to act renouncing the ego and egocentric desires. This is more easily said than done, however, because they are powerful and deep-rooted urges. The baser urges can only be eliminated by working in a spirit of dedication to a higher and nobler ideal. To act with a spirit of surrender is to act in the spirit of yajna. Yajnas were the most popular community rituals known in Vedic times. On the banks of a flowing river, in a grand structure erected for the purpose, people assembled in a spirit of utter dedication. Everyone worked together without selfish motive. Each person tried to contribute toward the yajna. Their only purpose was the common welfare of all. As a single happy community, all invoked the blessing of the Lord. The ritual itself centered around a fire trough. Into the blazing fire, every one offered a mixture of 9 grains accompanied by the chanting of Vaidika mantras. The invocation of the Lord was a prayer for community happiness, the nation's glory, and the welfare of the world, and not for the fulfillment of any personal desires. These yajnasala were communal classrooms where people learned the spirit of working together without egocentric desires. This yajna spirit was later completely veiled from the people, and only the pomp and show of the ritual continued to attract the attention of the masses. At such time, it must have been a revolutionary concept to have Lord Krishna expound karma yoga to them in the language of the already known ritual. The world is bound by actions other than those performed for the sake of yajna. Therefore, O son of Kunti, you perform actions of yajna alone without attachment. That is in Bhagavad Gita 3.9. Every action can become a sacred yajna. Every action. If we act without ego or egocentric desires, even the dreary, dull, daily routines from all walks of life can be divinized into sacred worship if we perform them as offerings to the Lord, or God, or the universe, or the collective, or the whole. We generally act in dedication to wife or to children, and naturally our achievements are small and limited. Our abilities will increase according to the glory of the altar of our dedication. Thus, the ambassador of a country, otherwise an ordinary man, can sign for his country on trade agreements. It is no longer he as a person who is signing for his personal gain. He signs for the country that he represents. Thus, the spirit underlying the most popular Vaidika ritual can be practiced not only in the yajnasala, but it can be brought to bear in all actions, whether in home, office, factory, or in the fields. In the above verse, Lord Krishna has advised Arjuna to perform all his duties as an army officer in the spirit of yajna. He emphasizes 2 features that must be maintained in all action. 1, it must be performed efficiently, and 2, it must be undertaken and executed without attachment. If we are to gain mental poise and beauty from the work undertaken, we should be efficient in the performance of all our actions. People tend to be efficient while performing their own work, but when it comes to volunteer or social work, they become careless and inefficient and work only half-heartedly without a high ideal. People do not find an altar high enough to negate their ego and egocentric desires in order to execute a selfless program of work. Therefore, naturally, we find a larger play of the shameless ego and its baser desires all over the world. To be released from the bondage of our past is to rediscover a freed personality, capable of seeing life as it is and reacting to life spontaneously without being controlled by vasana. So let us do all our actions in a spirit of dedication to the Lord. Then all our work, good, bad, or indifferent, will become a continuous worship of Him. Living without attachment, apart from performing all duties and fulfilling all engagements with maximum efficiency, we must have an attitude of unattached within. The word unattached or asakta is often used in the Bhagavad Gita, but unless we understand its full import, we are apt to misunderstand the entire philosophy behind it. We all have attachments. We are attached to our parents, spouse, children, work, property, and so on. But what is attachment? It is certainly not physical. When we say that we are attached to our pets, we only mean a mental attachment. Whenever we have a strong feeling of want for any being or thing, that is attachment. The intensity of attachment is always directly proportional to the intensity of our demand of I want. Thus, there are two factors, I, the ego, and want, the desire to possess and enjoy. The ego, self-identification with the body, mind, and intellect, and egocentric desires together constitute attachment. Our lingering anxiety to gain and enjoy specific fruits from the action spoils our inspiration to act and saps our present efficiencies. When we perform our work efficiently, we grow and our community grows with us. While performing any actions, we can refuse to burden ourselves with worries and anxieties over the results of actions. The results of actions depend upon the quality of our action. Therefore, the seeker should function purely in the spirit of work for the sake of the work. We see this spirit everywhere around us, from the twinkling stars to the flowing rivers. Nature serves the world in the yajna spirit. Sun shines, but demands no appreciation from anyone. Rains fall, rivers flow, plants flower, trees bear fruit. Oceans heave, towering mountains stand, all serve the world, making it what it is. And not one of them seems to demand even a passing recognition from the people benefited by them. They all perform their duties and attain fulfillment in the very performance. The entire world of cosmic powers and natural phenomena function instinctively in the service of others. Even before life appeared on the face of the earth, the elemental forces had prepared the field through their constant activities performed with a spirit of dedication. As life developed and evolved at all levels, we can easily recognize different degrees of yajna activities which maintain the harmonious growth of existence. Every sentient and insentient member of the cosmos instinctively follows the law of seva, the universal law of sacrifice. Man alone is given the freedom to act as he likes. But to the extent he disobeys that universal law, to the extent he suffers because he, with his arrogant and egoistic actions, brings a discord to the harmony around him. But when individuals in a community strive cooperatively without ego or egocentric desire, the cosmic forces that constitute the environment will also cherish them. In short, when man works with the yajna spirit, the outer circumstances miraculously change their patterns to be conclusive to the common will of the community. which strives for the good of all. In nature, this law of seva was set in motion at the beginning of creation. It is a natural law. He who understands nature's laws and lives in harmony with them will be benefited by nature. The more we probe into the secrets of nature, the more nature reveals her laws, and obeying them, we end up increasing our harmonious existence with the phenomenal world. It's very important. It's more important than the law of attraction, or it's the way that you can use the law of attraction effectively to manifest anything that you want. It is a natural law. You can see it all around you. If you understand these laws, this is very important. This concept of yajna stems from the recognition of the one supreme divinity that is at once the core of all and yet transcends the universe of names and forms. All are but the one infinite self, Brahman, God, the universal mind, the one infinite creator. This perception of the play of the one self, both as matter and spirit, both as ourselves and the world around us, is the true vision of the Lord of the universe. He wants you to see that you are one with everyone, that you are the same self. When you begin to serve other selves as if you would serve your own self, acting as if they are you, it changes everything. It's very difficult to walk by somebody who is in need of service without giving it. And by dedicating ourselves to the service of the nation, the community, the home, and the individuals around us, we are dedicating ourselves to the one infinite self. We see ourselves everywhere and his plays in all activities. The devoted servant is never bound by the result of his actions, but he attains the intimate inner experience of the self divine. An individual whose limited egoistic ideas are replaced by the constant recognition of the Lord as supreme becomes an efficient instrument for the expression of the divine will. The purification of our personality is only possible when the mind is made to constantly sing the divine song, praising the glories of the one self. In the song of truth, the heart begins to beat with the highest of divine impulses. Actions performed by such an individual are no more ordinary actions, but they become expressions of the supreme will. Rodney Smith called it expressing our practice, saying that whenever you find yourself yearning to lead a more nourishing spiritual life, what kinds of activities do you imagine yourself doing? Have you asked yourself, if I want to be more spiritual, what am I going to do? And if you're like most people, you may have specific practices and environments that you define as spiritual. They might include going to a house of worship or a meditation hall or quiet spot in nature and engaging in prayer, meditation, solitude, and self-reflection. These spiritual pursuits seem to foster a simpler, more peaceful life in which we might experience greater intimacy and self-worth. But with the many responsibilities of life and the other stuff that we have to do in the world, sometimes we just don't have that much time. We have precious little time to devote to such practices. It can be hard to find the time just to get 30 minutes. That's when you need it the most. When time does permit them, Our spiritual yearning is momentarily satisfied, just momentarily. And we feel aligned with the needs of our hearts. But generally, our spiritual practice remains kind of secondary as this other thing to our most pressing everyday activities with our kids, or family, or business. Is it possible that we are defining our spiritual practice in too narrow a way? Spirituality is 24/7. Perhaps we have become to attach to a particular form of spirituality, to a specific practice or set of circumstances. If we return to the intention behind our practices rather than adhering to strictly to a form that supports the intention, we may discover a new approach to spirituality, one that truly feeds our hearts. For me, that discovery has led to serving others as a practice of the heart. Service work is a form that seems to be common to all the sacred traditions of the world. It cuts through all artificial divisions between spirituality and life. Through it, we find that service can actually be an expression of prayer, an ongoing engaged meditation. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross once said that she had never meditated and never wanted to. She found it too dry. But when working with the dying, being intimately present with that person, listening fully and learning constantly, she was as focused as any meditator, sitting on the floor and attending to the breath. She was in fact meditating, but her meditation arose naturally from her concern for the dying, not through formal sitting practice. For her, meditation was an expression of her service to the dying. Service has a way of transforming our daily life into spiritual practice. If the service work is defined as breaking through the artificial barriers that seem to isolate us from the rest of life, then washing dishes, dressing, cooking, eating, and showering are not separate from our prayer or meditation. So all those little things that we have to do, taking the garbage out, cleaning the litter box, all those little things are just like prayers, just like meditations. When our daily activities teach us about our relationship to all things, our life becomes an unceasing prayer of the heart. Every action you're taking is an action for God, even when you have to take out the garbage or wash the dishes. We become less dependent upon specific practices because we are more aware of the interrelationship between who we are or meditation, but we no longer find that these are the only ways to access spiritual dimensions. Our heart becomes as available through a variety of contacts and relationships as it does through sitting meditation. We start being fed from life itself. My own discovery occurred after spending several years on retreat, Rodney Strong says. According a few years in Asia as a forest monk, when I began feeling that my practice was becoming dry, I was not sure why. My life was very serene and simple, but it did not feel complete. I felt in some undefined way that I needed to connect with the people and work with my heart. I had always thought that monastic life would fulfill my spiritual needs, and it did for a while, but I soon began to realize that the longing in my heart was not about to obey my spiritual design. So I decided to leave the monkhood and return to the West. Coming out of the forest was difficult because there's nothing to fall back on for security. My old spiritual practices were no longer as vital or as relevant as they once were. There was fear of going forward and there was no turning back. I felt very alone and exposed. I was not sure. I had the strength or focus to keep walking in a spiritual direction in the face of the growing responsibilities of a lay person. I needed a focus that could be applied universally, not just within a special environment, one that included others and was not dependent upon my aloneness. Around this time, I had a conversation about service with Ram Dass. I had always admired his understanding of engaged spirituality and looked forward to his advice. I told him I felt as if all my props had been removed and I was left with imperative service everyone, as Ram Dass's guru often advised his students. The problem was that I had no idea how to do it. Serve everyone. There are too many people and I did not feel up to the task. Ram Dass told me very compassionately that he did not know how to do it either. Somehow that helped. Okay, I thought. I'm on my own with no role models, no mentors for the leap I am about to take. That freed me up to be creative and to let the path unfold to my unique way, which eventually led to hospice work. In my search to learn how to serve, I have come upon a quotation by a writer named Harold Thurman Whitman that has been extremely helpful. I keep it on my desk and reflect on it. It keeps pulling me deeper and deeper into its meaning. It reads, "Do not ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, and then go and do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." Let us explore this quotation and see if we can understand service in light of waking up and becoming alive. Aliveness is our birthright. To come alive, we must align ourselves with our heart's desire. We just have to rediscover how to do that. The word aliveness implies wakefulness, awareness, and a connected passion for life. We may notice that the essence of aliveness is a pure quality distinct from the actions that spring from it, such as following our desires or avoiding our fears. No matter where we start with our understanding of aliveness, however, through investigation, we penetrate to new and deeper meanings of this word. We need to keep redefining the idea, allowing it to evolve beyond what we think it means. In this way, it will always be fresh and new as our aliveness itself. Serving versus helping. Exploring Whitman's observation takes away the enormous tension in trying to understand how to serve. It solves the problem of how to practice and fully participate in our lives at the same time. It says that service is not a burden. Rather, it defines service as that which feeds our aliveness. Helping was always a weight to me. It was like forced Christmas shopping. I really was not into it, but I thought I should be, and people expected me to do it. When I understood that service springs from generosity, not self-discipline, I began to tap the wellspring of energy from which generosity arises. This energy cannot be depleted as long as it is connected with my heart's interests. The vital understanding for me was that if felt like a burden, it was. If service comes out of should, it cannot be anything but an obligation. It is a responsibility. It is helping, not serving. Often the shift from helping to serving is only an attitude deep. I have a friend who worked as a waitress to put herself through college. She disliked the work and complained about it often. One day, I asked her what she wanted to do after she received her degree. She said she wants to serve people. We both laughed because it instantly became obvious that in essence, waiting tables is service work. We talked about what we needed to change in order for her to truly serve her customers. For the next 2 weeks, she attempted to bring a service attitude to her work by making eye contact with her patrons and working from the relationship. She served food rather than filling orders. She said it totally changed the way she perceived her job. The difference between serving and helping is the difference between being alive and being depleted. Helping is based on sacrifice, not strength. It is giving something to someone for a particular reason. Its intention is self-enhancement at the expense of someone whom we regard as underprivileged. The helper is rewarded by knowing that he or she is better off than the person being helped. When we help someone, subliminally we pass on a message of inequality In doing so, we diminish that person as a human being. We hold those we help in a fixed perspective and often refuse to allow them to grow. This is because if they grew out of their role, we would lose their contract we need to help. We become as dependent upon them as they are on us. Our minds can force another into an unequal relationship, but not our hearts. Genuine warmth cannot exist unless there is equality. Love sets no limits and harbors no judgment. When we serve, we are meeting and connecting through a reciprocal affection, not through comparison and evaluation. We are being served as much as they are. Within this profound connection, there is mutual appreciation. Our hearts naturally open in service work. How could it be otherwise? Service comes from the perception that we are not isolated beings. I get questions sometimes, how can I open my heart chakra? And I say, try to be of service. It will naturally open when you start to be of service. Every single moment, you're being of service. Every breath, every blink of the eye, you're being of service. But who are you being service to? Who serves whom and why? Swami Tiagananda tried to answer this question with this story. There were two brothers, one was married and the other was a bachelor. They owned a farm and shared its produce 50-50. The soil was fertile and they reaped a rich harvest every year. All went well for a few years. Then something extraordinary happened. The married brother began to wake up with a start from his sleep at night and think, it's not fair. My brother is not married. He needs to save much more for the future than me. A married man with a wife and 5 kids. I have all the security in the world. But what security has my poor brother? Who will look after him in his old age? My kids will care for me when I am old. My brother's need is greater than mine. With that, the married man would leave his bed, steal over to his brother's granary, and pour there a sack of his own share of grain. Now the bachelor brother, too, began to get these nightly attacks. He would wake up from his sleep and think, it's too bad that I should accept an equal share of the farm's produce as my brother who has a family to maintain. I am single and my needs are minimal. He has to support his wife and children. He deserves a larger share. So his brother would get up, take a sack of grain from his stock and empty it stealthily into his brother's granary. Once it happened that they got out of bed at the same time and ran into each other, each carrying a grain-filled sack on his back. Years later, when the townsfolk wanted to build a temple, the story of the two brothers who had passed away had leaked out by then. They chose the spot where the two brothers had met that night. This is the holiest place of all places in this town, the elders said, and a temple was constructed there. This story can serve as a good starting point for our discussion. Yes, service is indeed a holy act, and the place where service is done is a holy place. Above all, only a holy person can give true service. Why true service? Is there any such thing as false service? There is, but of course it is not called by that name. That complicates matters, so we must begin by identifying the distinctions between the two varieties of service. One variety of service we are all familiar with, it is something good done for others, prompted by the feelings of duty, pity, or guilt, or by the conscious or unconscious desire for name and fame, or for happiness here and in the afterworld, or just as a kind of social ritual. Service is a misnomer, really, for such an act. Good work is perhaps a better name. Good because it does help the person served to some extent and may bring a momentary feeling of satisfaction to the person who serves. But that's all it does, and no more. It brings lasting fulfillment to neither of the two, nor does it bring the joy of freedom. It is possible to do such good work and yet remain selfish, arrogant, frustrated, ambitious, in a negative sense, and immoral. Spiritually speaking, this variety of so-called service perpetuates ignorance and in the long run helps neither the individual nor society. It is clear there is nothing particularly holy about this work. If we must call it service, then we had better qualify the term with the adjective false. But there is the other variety of service that elevates the individuals and benefits society. This service is not the result of pity, duty, guilt, or desires. It is the result of the perception of oneness, of identity, with the person served. There is no hesitation or calculations before doing this kind of service. It is a spontaneous act that comes to one as naturally as breathing. It is free even from the idea, I am serving so-and-so, or I am doing the service. It's a free offering with no strings attached. Both the giver and receiver feel blessed and uplifted. There is service. And to distinguish it from the much too common variety described earlier, let us call this true service. This is the kind of service saints and genuinely holy men and women do. What this means really is that if you and I are able to extend the kind of service to everyone and everything around us, we too shall become genuinely holy. Perception of oneness is the mother of true service. But how many perceive oneness? We only see multiplicity and distinctions and differentiation everywhere. No two things are exactly identical. Yes, even twins are not identical in every respect. The basic distinction we observe is between this person who is me and everything that is other than me. The distinction between the I and the not I. I am different from the rest, and the rest differ among themselves. If there is someone called God, he too is different from me, just as he is different from everyone and everything else. Differences galore everywhere. Where is oneness? I can perceive oneness only if there is oneness. And if it is true that oneness exists, the question is, why don't I perceive it? This is the fundamental question before Vedanta. And its answer to this question is the only sensible answer that can be given. You don't perceive it because you don't want to perceive it. You are ignorant if you close your eyes and deny the sun because you don't perceive it. Does that mean the sun doesn't exist? This can't be countered, of course, by saying that everyone sees the sun, and the denial by an individual would be clearly invalid and unacceptable. But such is not the case with oneness. The fact is, no one sees the oneness, though quite a number of people talk or write about it. The perception of the many is a universal experience, and so cannot be wished away by simply saying that it is the result of ignorance. Vedanta teachers flatly deny this. They say that it is quite okay to say, I do not perceive oneness. But what right has one to claim that no one perceives oneness? If something is true in my case, must it be true in every other case also? If I am a fool, does that mean everyone in the world is also a fool? It's another matter, of course, that no fool believes he is a fool. I'm not the standard by which the world ought to be judged. So the claim no one perceives oneness is unacceptable. Vedanta teachers flatly deny this. They say that it is quite okay to say, I do not perceive oneness. But what right has one to claim that no one perceives oneness? If something is true in my case, must it be true in every other case also? If I am a fool, does that mean everyone in the world is also a fool? I am not the standard by which the world ought to be judged. So the claim no one perceives oneness is unacceptable. Vedanta teachers concede, however, that the number of people who perceive oneness is extremely small, almost microscopic, as compared to the billions who perceive the many. We may ask why these handfuls of people who see oneness are right, and the legions who see the many are wrong. For all we know, those who keep seeing oneness may just be cranks. Even if it is granted, they are not pretending. To this, Vedanta replies by saying that apart from the fact that the truth of oneness is validated by our ancient scriptures and is today also being admitted by modern science, the experience of oneness is known to have brought those people total, irrevocable fulfillment, joy, freedom, and perfection. This could never, never have been the result of a false experience. The experience of the many, on the other hand, is never known to have brought complete fulfillment, bliss, freedom, and perfection to anyone. Just look at those people that say that they've seen the oneness, and it has brought that to them. On the contrary, as we know from our own life, it perpetuates the sense of incompleteness, bondage, imperfection, and the alternating experience of fleeting happiness and sorrow. These are the very things every one of us is struggling, consciously or unconsciously, to overcome. If the experience of oneness can help us overcome these, and we know it has helped a few brave, determined souls in every generation, our common sense will tell us there must be something wrong with our present experience of seeing the many. That something wrong, says Vedanta, is ignorance. When did this ignorance come? The question has no answer. By the way, just because we are able to formulate a question doesn't mean it has an answer. If a child is ignorant about the number of gold medals the United States won at the Olympics and asks, when did this ignorance come? What answer do we have? All we can do is to tell the little one, I do not know when your ignorance came, but I can tell you how you can remove it. Then we pass on to him the knowledge we have of the number of gold medals, and the child's ignorance vanishes. That is exactly what Vedanta teaches. Don't bother about when your ignorance came. Recognize its presence and focus on how you can get rid of it. The method is simple enough, at least in its description. Where else need we go for this than Sri Ramakrishna and the Holy Mother? Here are Sri Ramakrishna's words. If one thing is placed upon another, you must remove the one to get the other. Can you get the second thing without removing the first? And here are Holy Mother's thoughts. You have rolled different threads on a reel, red, black, and white. While unrolling, you will see them all exactly in the same way. Plain common sense. The knowledge of our true self is covered by ignorance. To get knowledge, ignorance has to be removed first. This is what Sri Ramakrishna's words seem to signify. Holy Mother's words deal with the steps that separate knowledge from ignorance. And she says that you have to go back the same way you came. From the experience of oneness, we have somehow come today to the experience of the many. If we only know the steps that have brought us down from the heights of oneness to the depths of multiplicity, we can then go upward by tracing the same steps in reverse gear. Vedanta says that in the beginning there was only being, the self. One without a second, the self was all that existed. It was complete, purna, eternal, nitya, infinite, ananta, indivisible, akanda, pure, suddha, conscious, Buddha, and free, mukta. Then something mysterious seems to have happened. Mysterious because it was quite irrational. A kind of division suddenly took place in what was really indivisible. The self, the one and only reality, somehow became fragmented into three apparently different entities. God, also called Paramatman, the Supreme Self, the world, sometimes called Anatman, the non-self, and I, called Jivatman, the individual self. When cracks appear, they have a tendency to spread, so a further fragmentation of these entities was inevitable. The world got divided and subdivided into countless number of objects and creatures of all sizes, shapes, colors, and characteristics. Identifying accurately any form of life can be quite a daunting task. Biologists have to consider at least the following 20 subdivisions to classify any creature accurately: kingdom, subkingdom, phylum, subphylum, superclass, subclass, infraclass, cohort, suborder, order, suborder, superfamily, subfamily, tribe, genus, subgenus, species, and subspecies. Quite a formidable list this is. And let us remember, this deals with only living creatures. Physics, chemistry, astronomy, geology, oceanology, and 100 other sciences deal with the world of inanimate objects. The extent and variety of divisions in the universe are too mind-boggling. Subdivisions took place in the individual self too. To begin with, there was the obvious division into body and mind, and the not-so-obvious estrangement of the two from the inner self. The mind was subdivided into the conscious, or the ego, and the subconscious, or the id. These divisions were peculiar. They divided the personality without taking apart the individual fragments. It was something like a marriage on the rocks, but the unfortunate couple continuing to live under the same roof naturally. This gave rise to stress and strain. The body and mind were separated, but they continued to influence each other. The unconscious and conscious parts of the mind were divided, but they continued to pull and drag the individual, often in mutually opposing directions. The net result of all these multiple fragmentations was that the self became limited and localized. It became identified with a body and a mind, and alienated from everything else. Its identification with the body and mind, too, was not stable. Sometimes it identified itself with the body, sometimes with the mind, sometimes with both, and sometimes with neither, as in deep sleep. The person became alienated from the spiritual essence of his being, and worse, did not even know that he was so alienated. The conscious part of his mind became alienated from the unconscious, as well as from the world around. In this way, the self became even more narrowed down as it got identified not with the whole personality, but only with a fragment of it at any given time. The other fragments thus remained alienated, and it is they who destroyed man's peace, upset his harmony, and robbed him of his sense of fulfillment and wholeness. Thus man became, so to say, alienated from himself or herself. Much has been written about self-alienation. Some of the best minds in the fields of spirituality, philosophy, psychology, and sociology have pored over the problem of alienation. Their interpretations varied because their ideas of the self varied, and also because their perspectives and approaches were different. Nevertheless, they have come up with valuable insights and have enriched our understanding of this central problem of human existence. We have seen how we descended from the state of oneness to the state of mutually conflicting many. From the one to the many, the descent is complete. The fall of man, allegorized in the story of Adam and Eve, was from the state of oneness, from one has emerged the many, and the many must merge back into the one. The fallen man must rise again. The upward march toward unity must begin. The broken fragments constituting the many must be joined. The divisions must be cemented. In plain words, alienation must be removed. It is here the service comes into the picture. From the many to the one. There are two approaches to the problem of overcoming the many. First, the traditional approach. When pieces have to be joined together, or when cracks have to be mended, we use an adhesive. Love is the adhesive that joins the many into one. Complete, whole. Love grows into an unselfish person and expresses itself through service. So first and foremost, we must all become unselfish and force ourselves to sacrifice for others and to do good to others. This is the Judeo-Christian, or more specifically modern Western, approach to social service. With the almost global proliferation of Western technology and along with it, Western values, this approach is today found even in many parts of the Eastern world. Here the self is objectified, and certain moral rules are thrust upon it. The person is expected to become unselfish, or loving, or charitable, and so on. The aim is to become someone different from what one is. This involves needless struggle, and usually produces inner conflicts. Moreover, one seldom succeeds fully in the struggle to become this and that. People go on trying to become unselfish, and to prove the point, doing good to others, but in the process, create a lot of unhappiness for themselves and others. Most of the efforts at social service in modern times show this phenomenon. In the West, social service is more organized. In a sense, it comes naturally to Westerners as a result of years of social discipline and upbringing. Thousands of small and big institutions and millions of men and women, young and old, are engaged in volunteer services every day. One would expect that with so many unselfish people around, the society here would be ideal. Would to God it was so. But we see that in spite of all the so-called unselfishness of the modern man and woman, we see divorce and violence and rapes and drug addictions and neuroses and wars. We see black money. We see secret societies steadily increasing, and the social structures crumbling in many parts of the world. How do we explain this strange phenomena? Why should such a thing happen? Vedanta provides the answer. When self-alienated people do social service, they only increase their self-alienation and consequently their selfishness. Those portions of man's personality from which he is alienated act like enemies, and he develops a kind of hatred for them. But they are all parts of his own self, and his hatred is really a subtle kind of self-hatred. This produces inner insecurity and the fear of facing oneself. Have you ever noticed that? When you find somebody that really hates a particular group or anything, they're just somebody that really has a lot of hate. It's usually because they hate themselves. Self-hatred can manifest in two ways. A person may project his self-hatred outward upon other people and thus attempt to cover up his inner hatred, fear, and distrust by accumulating everything for himself and refusing to share it with others. Such a person we call selfish. In some cases, self-hatred gets projected inward, and the person tries to escape from himself or avoid himself by busying himself with the affairs of others. He decides to become unselfish by trying to solve others' problems. The underlying, undeclared, and often unacknowledged reason being his fear of being left alone to confront his own problems. We may laud and cheer this frightfully unselfish person without realizing that he is spending all his time and energy for others, not out of a sense of duty, compassion, sympathy, or love for them, or an awareness of the oneness with them. Though these may be the ostensible reasons, but to avoid the horror and pain of confronting himself in the silence of his heart. This is a reason why I used to drink, because I couldn't confront the self in that sober place in the silence. So I would drink to escape it, to escape the guilt, to escape the memories of my past. Now, I'd love to talk about this more if you really want to talk about it. We can talk about love and truth in service. We can talk about love and how it works, in particular in reference to service. We can talk more about the Vedantas. We can talk about joyful service. Sri Dayamada has an amazing writing on that. Or Service as a Gift of Love by Jonathan Roof is one I recommend. There's so many good writings out there on service. A lot of amazing spiritual gurus have really discussed service and all of the different aspects of selfless service, selfish service. Developing the Spirit of Service is a great writing by Swami Jayatiramayananda. I also recommend Leslie Keen, her discussion of the revolution of the spirit and fearlessness when being of service. There's so much more. So if you guys want me to, we can discuss some of these other teachings on the powers of service. But the primary idea for you to understand is that there's a decision that you have to make. A decision of who you want to be of service to. Now, I ask anybody listening, do you remember when you made that decision? I remember exactly where I was sitting. I remember what time it was during the day. I remember the vision I had in my head. I remember when I openly said out loud, I am service to others. Why did it take me so long to realize I had to make that choice? Of course, I had been service to others my whole life, but had I? I was not aware of the battle of self within self or the oneness. I was walking in the zombie land of reality in the matrix, not really understanding what was happening around me. And the aliveness, becoming alive, talking about this stuff brought me into that feeling of liveliness. And I'd like to know where you were sitting, what you were doing. When you made the choice, have you made the choice? And when you do, don't do it for any reason, to gain anything in particular. But tell me about what happens. I want to know your stories. I want to know about the magical power that it ends up giving you, even though that is not the reason that you're doing it. So please tell me about your choice. I want to know about it. Tell me all about it. Tell me how it felt. Tell me what happened afterwards. Tell me about the opportunities of service that you had. Tell me your stories, because these stories I can share or others can share. Put them in the comments. Tell me what happened after you did it. When you truly felt like you crossed that threshold, when you started doing it on a regular basis, when you changed the way you thought and you realized that you were being of service in every moment, finding the love in every moment, feeling the natural vibrancy of that aliveness. And everybody has this one unique thing about them that they can offer, that no one else can offer. I promise, just go back to your childhood. You have something about you. That's the best thing I can tell you, is to go back to your childhood. Something really fascinated you when you were a kid that made you super happy. Is there anything that you let go that you miss? Is there something that you always really love that you would rather be doing right now? I know it sounds crazy, but that thing that you love, that you really love, maybe you're not quite aware of it, or it's related to that thing, is how you can be of service And then it really is fun because it's something you enjoy anyway, and it's a service no matter what. The artist has pure joy when he paints the painting. The musician has that pure joy in the song when they have that vibe, right? In that moment, they are being of service to everyone. Think of those amazing songs that you've heard so many times. Think of those amazing songs and how they've changed your life. All of that was of service from that place, in many of them. And you can find a place, a way to be of service, different than you think. It's not a burden. It's not a job. It's not something tough, something extra, a chore that you have to do. It's not. It's love. Recently, I went to the grocery store. Some, of course, we all have to do every week, right? Or every other week, or however you do it, right? And I walked into the grocery store. I've always been super excited by the idea of Paul Selig, where he says, you just see everybody there. And you declare to yourself, I know who you are, I know what you are, I know how you serve. You are free, you are free, you are free. Because it felt like in that moment when I said that, it felt like I was connecting to all those souls at a higher self level, where I was connected with all their higher selves in that moment. And this amazing service was being offered. All the people there were free in that moment. As I said, I know who you are, I know what you are, I know how you serve. You are free, you are free, you are free. And I started to see everybody, and you start looking at people and you imagine their best self. You just see in an instantaneous moment, you transform them into their perfect version and only see them as that perfect version. You see the 400-pound woman in perfect shape. You see the woman with her cane walking sturdily, healthy, vibrant. You see that man with confidence and smiling. You start to do it and you imagine them. You can adjust them in your mind while you're walking around. You see them. It takes just a glimpse. Could be while you're driving. It could be somebody that you see while you're stopped at a stoplight. And you start transforming them, imagining for them. Can you imagine the kind of service that you're doing for them? When you began your incarnation, you were given something so amazing, the power of Aladdin's lamp, the ability to make any wish and have it answered every second with every breath. Every breath is a wish. And you can use every breath to wish not just for one person, but for the whole planet, for the whole universe. You can start to breathe into the flow of the oneness. You start to become aware that the one is you. The oneness seeps into you and you start to see other people. And there are these moments you have when you're around people, sometimes even online, and you are instantly in their body and you're aware of their whole life. You know everything about them. It just fits perfectly. You have their vibe, what kind of foods they eat, what kind of sense of humor they have. You know everything, their whole history. And you're from them, and then you are them, and then you have this amazing love for them. And then from then on, like whenever you see them, it's you, and you can identify with what's going on with them. And so you have the experience of the oneness with that person. And for me, it's like a montage, like a movie, like really super fast frame shot of their whole existence in that shot from first person perspective, meaning that I could see their world from their eyes, feel their feelings, understand their thoughts. And oftentimes this means seeing where somebody is coming from, even when they're wrong. You meet people and they're misinformed or they don't understand. And you say, oh, you don't understand. You've been brainwashed or you're ignorant, right? But when you see from them, you understand why they think like that. And you still understand them in a way that you can still love them because you are them. It's not really that big a deal. You understand them on a regular basis, what's really deep down going on and how they hate themselves. The hatred for themselves oftentimes is what you'll see. And so then when you express the love for yourself, you're also expressing the love for them, that person in that blink of an eye that you imagined their whole life, and you put yourself in their shoes and imagined that you were that person. And then you realize that you are, because you are one with everyone. That simple flash, that moment where you consider them in that way, as the self, as yourself, as you being one with them. Then you are going to be of service to them, because that's you. It's not really service. When you eat some food, are you being of service to your body? Yeah, you are. But if somebody else needs some food, that's yourself. So you start doing this to everybody, and you realize you've completely changed the way you act, the way you think, the way you work, and the way you love. And I want that for you. This is the love power. This is the secret to the love power, is the application of it. And here is an opportunity to use the magic of love. And all you got to do is make a choice. You can find all episodes of The Reality Revolution at therealityrevolution.com. And welcome to The Reality Revolution.